Welcome back. In our second presentation for Chapter 17, Financial Ratios and Ratio Analysis, we're going to take a look at the rest of the financial ratios that are on the formula sheet, and in the book, obviously, in Chapter 17. So you're going to want to have that handy. It'll help. The formulas are in the presentation also, but it'll help to take a look at that because that is what you're going to use when you take a look at your financial statements for whatever companies you're interested in. And I think it would help to have the balance sheet and the income statement handy for if we're going to use Ford in our presentation, just so that you can check to make sure I did it right, okay? Because I'm going to throw it up on the screen, but it would be good for you to see the entire financial statements. We're only going to see a little bit of it because they don't all fit in the presentation window here. So have all those resources available. Have a calculator or a spreadsheet if you want to use a spreadsheet. And I've already got my cheat sheet here. I've already done the calculations. Okay, so. And in the face-to-face class, what we would do is we would do them as we run along. Not all. We don't do all of them, folks, just because once you do a few, you get the hang of it. You just got to figure out to get the right numbers. So let's start on slide number 20 with the profitability ratios. The profitability ratios allow one to measure the ability of a firm to earn an adequate return on sales, return on total assets, and return on invested capital. So we're going to take a look at these. A couple of them are very, very popular. You'll see people discuss the return on assets, the return on equities quite a bit, the net profit margin, the after-tax profit margin also. And then often when they dig deep down, then they're interested in the operating margin. And as usual, we want to not only look at the company that we're interested in, but the competitors. And as Peter Lynch says, that's often how he got his best investing ideas, by looking at the competitor of the company that he was interested in and saying, ooh, this looks better. This is a better deal. Slide number 21, the net profit margin, or sometimes called the after-tax profit margin. The rate of profit being earned from earnings after expenses and taxes. So here what we're doing, folks, is we're comparing the bottom line, our net income, with our top line, our total revenue. And of course, the higher the better. That means you're squeezing more income out of your revenue, but you have to look at it from a industry to industry. You have to look at the competitors and look at the industry itself. You can't compare the company we're looking at, Ford, with a company like Farcebook, because it's a totally different industry. So let's run over to the income statement, because these numbers are on the income statement. So there's our top line number, so write that down, $151 billion, $800 million. And then where's our bottom line? At the bottom, $45.96, or almost $5 billion. So you take the net income, the bottom line, divided by the top line, and what do we get? Well, I got 3%, 3.03. Is that good? Is that bad? I don't know. You got to look at other car companies. And it turns out that that's typical, folks, because they have such huge investments to make those cars. And don't forget, we're not looking at the depreciation in this case. Some people would say, well, you're not looking at all the cash that the company actually pulled in. Right, we're looking just at the bottom line. But still, as long as we're comparing apples to apples, as long as we're comparing these numbers to GM and Honda and Toyota, then we can make a reasonable comparison. Okay? Excuse me. The next one is the gross margin, ew, gross. Well, that's the same idea, folks. But instead of looking at the net income, we look at the gross profit. So that's just using a different number on the income statement. So we go back up to where we see gross profit, and we compare the gross profit with that top line number. And remembering the gross profit is a whole lot higher because look at all these huge fixed costs we have here. And so if you divide the 16,312 divided by the 151,800, you can ignore the last three zeros, you get a gross margin of 10.75%. Make sure I got it right, folks. I mess up. Make sure, check it out with on your income statement and your calculator. Is that good? Is that bad? I don't know. Let's take a look at their competitor and see how it compares to their competitor. Just as we did in the previous presentation when we looked at the different PEs, let's look at the different net profit margins and gross margins and operating margins. Same idea, but this case, instead of using the net income or the gross profit, we use operating income, just a different number on the income statement. Here it is right here. Ta-da! And we get about 3% also, a little almost 2.7 or so, almost 3%. So very similar, very similar. And so, yep. You guessed it, the higher the better, and it varies greatly from industry to industry, so I'm repeating myself, but it bears repeating. When you're looking at a specific company, we always need to look at its competitors with the industry. When we find a company that is atypical of its competitors, it doesn't necessarily mean that we shouldn't pursue it. It doesn't necessarily mean we should. It is a signal that we just have more investigative work to do to understand why this company is different from its competitors. What is it that's making this number yell at us? Like, I like to think of it like a little red flag yelling, hey, look at me, look at me. You got more work to do. It doesn't mean you shouldn't buy it. Doesn't mean you should. It's just another clue in the puzzle. Aha. Okay, slide number 24, return on assets. These two, the next two, this return on assets and return on equity, are very popular in the industry. We take our net income and we divide it by the total assets. It measures how profitable a company is relative to its total assets. It looks at the amount of resources a company needs to support the operations, and it reveals how effective the company is in generating profits from the assets that it has available. And of course, the higher the better. So now we're going to need that net income from the income statement. Do you remember what it was? Let's go back and find it. That was $4,596,000,000, almost $5 billion. But now this time we're going to compare it to our total assets. So now we have to go to the balance sheet and sneak on down here to total assets. So almost $238 billion of assets. That's the nature of car companies, folks. And so we get a return on assets, which is pretty paltry. Almost 2%, 1.93%. Doesn't sound too exciting, but if you compare it to other car companies, I'll bet you it's pretty similar, right? Do it. Compare it to their competitors. Why? Because of the sheer amount of assets that a car company has to have to produce those vehicles. However, what we're going to do now is take a look at its cousin here, return on equity. And this is a measure of the overall profitability of a company in relation to the equity, what is owned by the shareholders. In other words, instead of using total assets, you use stockholders' equity. And as it says below, this return on equity, return on investment, is sensitive to the amount of debt a company is carrying. If a company carries a great amount of debt, then the return on equity will be much larger than return on assets. And you hear people say, well, you're using other people's money to make your money. Now, this is a good and a bad thing, right? It's a great thing because you're using other people's money to make your money. But others are worried about the possible negative consequences of carrying too much debt. And this is what got the car companies in serious trouble during the financial turmoil, because their revenue just simply disappeared. And now they've got these mounting debts, and they had to do something about them. And they did. And our government helped get them through that difficult time. And all the debts have been paid off, folks. All the debts, although some people are still angry that the government stepped in 2009 and 10 and helped GM and Chrysler. Did not help Ford. Ford, they were going to need help, but then they did everything they could. Very smart cookie. He's retired now, but the CEO at the time, Jim Mullally, did everything he could not to take any government assistance, and they begged, borrowed, and stole. They even hocked the Ford emblem. That's right, folks. They put the Ford emblem in the pawn shop, and it's out now. They got it back and didn't take any money from the government. Well, it didn't. None of the car companies took money. They were given guaranteed loans in case they didn't pay them back. So we're going to now take a look at the net income and divide that by the equity. And what we're going to find in the case of car companies, which have tremendous debt, you're using other people's money to make your money. Go back to that net income. There it is. Again, almost $5 billion, $4,596. And now divide it by stockholders' equity. There, the stockholders' equity. Right, $29,170. And it turns out that this is almost 11%, right? No, wait, where am I? Almost 16%. Gotta get my cheat sheet better. 15.76%, much higher than the return on assets. Why? Because of the great amount of debt that is on the books of Ford or any car company. So, exactly. This one is showing us that our return on our investment, what the stockholders own, is much higher than the return on the assets. And some people, as we said, think that's a good thing. And other people are a little worried about the debt. And as long as the economy keeps zipping along, car companies are very profitable, so no need to worry about paying the piper. Slide 26. Those were the profitability ratios. Now let's take a look at the liquidity ratios. Liquidity, you know what that means, right? The ability to raise cash in the short term to make sure you're liquid. You can pay your debts. You can make your payroll, pay the taxes. And so the financial ratios that are liquidity ratios are concerned with a firm's ability to meet its day-to-day operating expenses and satisfy its short-term obligations as they come due. Yeah, in other words, can you pay the rent next month? The current ratio is one of the more popular ones. And then the acid test ratio sounds kind of scary, huh? Well, that's just a little more stringent version. The net working capital is a little strange. It's the only number that we're going to discuss today that isn't really a ratio. It's the net working capital in absolute dollars. And these use the balance sheet. So let's take a look at the first one. The current ratio, one of the more popular financial ratios. The current ratio is a good indicator of how stable a company is. Anything over 1 is normally considered acceptable. If your current assets equal or exceed your current liabilities, you should be able to satisfy your short-term obligations without any problems. Obviously, the greater the number is, the better. Until you get to a situation like the tech companies in the 2000s, which, like Microsoft is a tremendous example. They had tens of billions of dollars in cash just sitting in the bank. And, you know, they had already written Word and Excel and Windows and were in the process of continually destroying them as they rewrote them. And their current ratios were in the hundreds because they just didn't have that much debt. So finally said, okay, let's start paying out some dividends. But in our case of Ford, we're going to take the current assets and current liabilities, and we're going to find that, no, it's not in the hundreds. Let's go to the balance sheet and go up to current assets. Here they are, $108,461. And then we're going to divide that by the current liabilities, $90 billion. How do you like to have a $90 billion bill coming in within the next year? Well, you're not worried. You got $108 billion in the bank. So if we do that calculation, what do I got? 1.2. So yeah, Ford can meet his short-term debts. No problem. And so we're going to now take a look at the net working capital, which is really not a ratio. It's simply the current ratio expressed as a dollar amount. You take the current assets and subtract the current liabilities. So it's the net working capital is the current ratio in dollar terms. If the current ratio is greater than 1, then net working capital will be positive. That just means there's more current assets than there are current liabilities. If the current ratio is less than 1, then it will be negative because there's more debts than there are assets. Obviously, the higher the better. This statistic is less popular than the current ratio, and as we said, it's really not a ratio. But it's often discussed when discussing the current ratio and other liquidity ratios. Why? Because it tells us what we have in dollar terms. And in the case of Ford, you take the $108 billion minus the $90 billion, and you wind up with over $18 billion in net working capital. Yes, Ford's not in danger of going bankrupt anytime soon, folks. They got plenty of money, plenty of cash sitting in the bank that they can use to weather the next storm. They're ready. Okay, now, acid test. Doesn't that sound scary? Well, it's kind of scary. It's the quick ratio. It's a more stringent, a tougher version of the current ratio. And so what does it do? It takes out the inventory. So to make life easier, folks, you can add the cash and the accounts receivable and the short-term investments and the other assets, or you can simply subtract the inventory from the current assets. That's a little easier. And so how is this different? Well, the asset test ratio, unlike the current ratio, excludes the inventory. Now, why would you want to exclude the inventory? Well, it depends on the industry. But this ratio measures the ability of the company to meet its short-term debt obligations, even if the current inventory becomes obsolete or undesirable, and hence difficult or impossible to be turned into cash. In other words, what would happen if all of a sudden all of Ford's existing inventory of cars became obsolete? Now, this isn't going to happen. I mean, after the new model year comes out, they discount them, but the car is still worth, a car doesn't go obsolete just because it's an older, year-older model. But computers and other technology becomes obsolete in a few months. And so, yes, we definitely would be interested in the quick ratio, the acid test ratio, for companies like Dell or HP or other computer companies. And this is why companies like Dell pioneered just-in-time manufacturing, because they didn't want inventory sitting around knowing that within, a few months nobody's going to want their computers because they're oh so old. Indeed. So if we take out the inventory, let's go run back to the balance sheet. If we take out the inventory of about $3.368 billion, we still get a positive number, a number over 1. And what do I got? 1.1, just a little less than 1.2. So even if Ford's inventory became obsolete, which isn't going to happen, discounted, yes, but not obsolete, Ford can still meet its short-term obligations. So is Ford liquid? Yes, it is, indeed. Slide number 30. Now, the activity ratios measure a firm's ability to convert different accounts within their balance sheet into cash or sales. And what does this mean? Companies are going to try to turn that production into cash or sales as fast as possible because this will generally lead to higher revenues. Hang on a minute. Once you see an example, you'll say, okay, I understand. I think I can figure this out. So let's go to the accounts receivable turnover. Now, you accountants know what this is, right? This is money that is owed to us. And it's a measure of how the accounts receivables are managed. You take the top line number, the total revenue, and you divide it by the accounts receivable. And the higher the number, the better. It indicates the return a company is getting from its investments in accounts receivable. Huh? That's an investment? Well, yes. By maintaining accounts receivables, firms are indirectly extending interest-free loans to their clients. But it's a great way to get clients, right? And business-to-business, this is just how things work, folks. A high ratio implies that the company either operates on a cash basis or its extension of credit and collection of accounts receivable is efficient. In other words, they don't have any deadbeat clients. People are paying their debts, their short-term accounts receivable debts. A low ratio implies that the company should reassess its credit policies in order to ensure the timely correction of imparted credit, not earning interest for the firm. In other words, get those deadbeats to pay up. Or that just may be how the industry operates. And one such example is the defense industry. You make a big old aircraft carrier for Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam gets around to paying you in his good old sweet time. If anybody's ever worked in the military or part of the defense, you know this. It's gotten better. I haven't worked in the defense industry in a million years, folks. But as I remember, then people just rolled their heads and said, yeah, we'll get paid, but it's going to take a long time. And then the smaller contractors were getting squeezed because they just didn't have the ability to withstand such a slow cash flow. And so my understanding is that the government has gotten better paying faster. But still, so let's take a look. So it depends on your industry. Let's take a look at Ford's. We have to get the total revenue. Do you remember that one, that big number? That huge number, right, the top line, 151,800, and then we're going to divide it by our accounts receivable. Now, that's a big number, folks, $57 billion. That's not typical of most industries, but in the case of car companies, yes, that's very typical. So it turns out, where's my cheat sheet, that they're turning over their accounts receivable 2.5 times a year. Not typical for most industries, but very typical in the car companies. So every 6 months or so, four months, the accounts receivable is being turned over. Yeah. And not usually something that many companies want to deal with, but that's something that's just in the car industry. Let's now take a look at the inventory turnover. And this is a measure of how the inventory is managed. And here is something that typically companies want to get up. They want to get this number up. Because the higher the number, the less time an item spends in the inventory, and the better the return the company is able to earn from the funds that are tied up in inventory. Because inventory ain't making you any money. This is the plight of the car dealership. All those cars sitting on your lot, they ain't making you any money until they sell. So But you have to have all those cars on the lot, or you can't get customers to come onto the lot, right? So it's an eternal struggle. As with all ratios, we got to compare this against the industry's averages. A low turnover implies poor sales and therefore excess inventory. A high ratio either implies strong sales or not a very good buying or maintenance program. In other words, you keep turning stuff over so fast, you're not having enough on the lot. High inventory levels are unhealthy because they represent an investment with a rate of return of zero. And it also opens up the company up to trouble in the case of falling prices or obsolete products. So that's why you hear the dealers say, let's get these, it's a new model year, let's get these old things off the lot. Because while they're sitting there, they ain't making them any money. And in the case of Ford here, let's go my cheat sheet here. Let's go to get the inventory. We already know the top line number. Let's go back to the balance sheet. And as we said, our inventory is about $3.5 billion worth of cars there. And so if we divide that into our total revenue, that 151,800, we get 17 times. So Ford is turning over the inventory about, every 3 weeks or so. Yeah, 17 times a year, which is, pretty darn good. You see all the cars sitting on the lot, but you don't think about them as they turn over. But obviously, they don't. They're not selling. So that's pretty darn good, I think, for a car company. We need to look at its competitors, but that I would be happy turning over my inventory if I were selling cars 17 times a year. Okay. Now, the last activity ratio is the total asset turnover. And so this measures how the total assets are being managed. It's the same idea. Take that top line total revenue number, but this time divide it by the total assets. And remembering that our total assets in the case of car companies is a huge number, this measures the firm's efficiency at using assets to support sales and revenue. And the higher the better. Companies with low profit margins tend to have a high asset turnover. Think milk at the grocery store. Low profit margin, but they sell it to you every couple of days. Those with higher profit margins have lower asset turnover, such as a car company. You do this calculation, that top line number divided by the total assets. Remember, go back and look at those. Those are about $237 billion. Let's go back. Where's that balance sheet? Yeah, total $238 billion almost. And you get a very low number, 0.63%. Very 6.37 or so. Very low number. But that makes sense. They don't sell as many cars as they do milk cartons and at a grocery store. So they have a lower asset turnover, higher profit margin. People sometimes think, how much does it cost a car to build a car? And the truth is, it doesn't really cost that much to build a single car. Indeed, right. The variable cost. If you've taken the managerial accounting class, you know what I'm talking about. The variable costs are relatively small, but the fixed costs are huge. And so, the Ford will say, Mr. Viano is absolutely right. It doesn't cost us a whole lot to make a single car. But before we could make that single car, we had to invest a tremendous sum of money into our fixed costs. So this is why the car companies have low total asset turnover. Okay, continuing. Now, the leverage ratios. Leverage. There's that silly word. We're going to come back to leverage when we get to bonds and then to other miscellaneous topics at the end of the semester, because leverage is a proxy. It's a substitute for debt in the industry. You'll hear people talk about a leveraged buyout, indeed. And so let's read at the bottom, because I just remarked about that. Debt is often referred to as leverage. The idea is that you are using other people's money to make your money. You are using the borrowed money as a lever to increase your earnings. When one firm buys another firm using borrowed money, it is often referred to as a leveraged buyout. So these financial ratios are used to measure the amount of debt that is being used to support operations and the ability of the firm to service its debt. Because as we said, as we mentioned briefly before, debt is a two-edged sword, right? It can help us increase our revenues. It can make us money, but then we have to be able to pay that debt back because it's a mandatory expense. And if we don't do it, we can be hauled off to bankruptcy court. So the debt-to-equity ratio, the times interest earned, this is one was very popular with Benjamin Graham, Warren Buffett's teacher, and then the total debt-to-total assets. And they use both the balance sheet and the income statement. So let's look at the first one, the debt-to-equity ratio. And this might look familiar to some of you in the Business 121 class because we do this to an individual. We take a look at their debt to their equity. This is a measure of a company's financial leverage calculated by dividing the long-term debt by the shareholder's equity. It indicates what proportion of equity and debt the company is using to finance its assets. So you take the long-term debt that's on the balance sheet and divide it by the total stockholders' equity. So let's go do it. Let's go run to the balance sheet. The long-term debt is, there it is, $93 billion, right? And then we divide that by how much of the company is belongs to the shareholders, $29 billion. And what do we get here? 319%, which is pretty high, but typical of companies like car companies that have tremendous debt and investments in debt. A higher debt-to-equity ratio generally means that a company has been aggressive in financing its growth with debt. Think car companies. This can result in lower earnings as a result of the additional interest expense, because interest is a deductible expense. Sometimes investors only use interest-bearing long-term debt instead of the total liabilities. And obviously the lower the better, because you just don't have to worry about all that debt sitting on the books. But in the case of some companies, high capital requirements like car companies, it's just what we see. Now, the next one is the times interest earned. Okay, so we have all this debt on the book. How many times every year do we earn enough to pay that interest? This is the measure of the company's ability to meet its fixed interest payments. So we go to the income statement and take the earnings before interest and taxes, and then divide that by how much we have to pay in interest, the interest expense. So what we're doing is we're determining how frequently interest payments are earned by the company. And, of course, the higher the better. So if we go to the income statement now, let's go find that income statement. Where is it? Here it is. Uh-oh, what happened? I didn't want that to happen. Why does it do that? You know what? I just really do not like this. I gotta see if I can get this is Adobe Reader, and they do strange things. I don't want this to happen, but it did happen. So how do I get rid of it? I don't know. Let's do that. Okay, that did it. I got rid of it. I'm doing some more strange things. So let's go take a look at the income before interest and taxes. Can you see that? $7.69 billion, 7690, And we're going to divide that by the 894, the interest expense, 894. And it turns out that Ford earns its interest about 8.6 times a year. In other words, about every 6 weeks or so, then they are earning their interest. So, yes, they're not going to get hauled off the bankruptcy court. They're able to pay their debts in eight and a half times a year. They earn that interest. And Mr., as I said, Mr. Benjamin Graham liked this one quite a bit. He talks about this one because he's worried about companies going bankrupt. And so, can you pay off your interest? Yes, you're not worried about going into bankruptcy court. And then the last financial ratio is the total debt to total assets. That takes a look at the total liabilities, and instead of comparing it to the stockholders' equity, what the company, the stockholders owned in the company, we compare that to the total assets. And this is a measure of how much of a company's total assets have been financed by debt. This includes both short-term and long-term debt, because the previous one just looked at the long-term debt, right? If it varies very substantially from the debt-to-equity ratio, the company may be relying heavily on short-term debt. And this can denote more risk. Not always. In the case of Ford and other car companies, you saw how huge the accounts receivable was, the accounts receivable number was, how high that was. So, and that's just typical for that industry. But if other industries, if another company is relying on building the company on short-term debt, they can get themselves in a lot of trouble if they can't make those short-term debt payments coming due. Maybe they're huge balloon payments. Think of it as an individual trying to finance a business startup, you know, a little startup like a pizza shop, or maybe their house with credit cards. Exactly. That can get you in a lot of trouble very quickly because those interest rates are really high, and you can get in a lot of trouble quickly. Whereas normally you want a long-term, low interest rate loan to deal with. So if we take a look at total debt to total liabilities to total assets, total debt to total assets on the balance sheet. Okay, let's go find that balance sheet. Our total debts are $208,685,000, and our total assets $237,000,000. So it turns out that 87%, right? 0.877 is our total debt to total assets, and that's fairly high, but that's typical of car companies. So take a look at the competitors and make sure that I'm not just making this stuff up, folks. Okay, and that, dear students, was our quick. I apologize if I went too quickly, but go back and look over it again and realize that this is, you know, pretty straightforward stuff, and we use it to round out the picture of the companies that we are interested in looking at. Okay? All right, now, dear students, very quickly, we have done the heavy lifting with regard to stock analysis. We've done our introduction to stocks and all the characteristics of stocks. We've looked at Chapter 6 and the dividend discount models and present value. And now we've taken a look and filled out all the nooks and crannies with financial ratio analysis and looking at the financial statements. Now it's time for a little silliness. Chapters 7 and 8, there's some good stuff in there, folks, but there's also some silliness that goes on within the industry, and it's to be expected. I guess every industry has its silliness, the investment industry being one of them. And we will then, once we've gone through Chapters 7 and 8, we will have finished our extensive coverage of the world of stocks. So now for your assignment, you're going to do basically what we've done in these two presentations for Chapter 17. You're going to dig into the financial statements of, I gave you five companies that you could play with, but you know, don't think you have to use those companies. But if you do use a different company, make sure it's a large cap company, unless you really have this aching for this small or medium sized company that you're interested in. But I'd rather you use a big company with, you know, serious assets, serious debts, and income, and real companies. Okay, so hope you've enjoyed our discussion of financial statements and ratio analysis. And see you in our next presentation in Chapter 7, where we take a look at stock price behavior and market efficiency.